and I don't want to ever meet anybody less ever again. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't learn this stuff in seminary. I need to tell you that. Those folks in seminary need a lot of help. They need to get a little faith is what they need to get, yeah. Oh, how can one forgive the suicide of a family member who had this disease? Well, you've just answered it. They had a disease. Of their right mind, they would have never done that. And it isn't about you. It's about their illness and their disease. I'm sorry for your loss, but to hate them does nothing but take away from their memory. And to hate them is hating someone who's got a deadly disease. What good would that do? What good does it do? All it does is ruin your life today, one day at a time. So I would suggest to them, close your eyes for a quick minute and envision their face and just tell them that you understand and you're sorry that they made that choice and you love them, and let them rest. That's what I'd suggest. All right. I would like to hear about forgiveness with acceptance. Excellent question. I hear from time to time, well, I'll forgive, but I'll never forget. Well, then don't bother. I really don't bother. Who are you kidding? Playing little word games, you know? Do you know how many times I've talked to my friend Sherman about the act of murdering my father? Just once, when I had some questions, and he answered them. It's none of my business anymore. It's just none of my business anymore. If I want to be accepted, I have to accept you. And that's tough, especially in this day and age. But it was tough when I walked through those doors. I was no piece of cake, I'll tell you. I came in those doors and I had long blonde hair and dark shades and a swastika around my neck. I don't know what it meant, but I sure knew it meant made people mad, and that was enough for me. And I had a look, had no look, and jeans on, leather boots. Hey, man, what's happening? I remember one day I walked in the meeting and somebody said, hey, Ed, how you feeling? I said, fine. And he said, why don't you tell your face? It don't know. If you want to talk about forgiveness, in our 12 and 12 is an excellent parameter. Oh, I can't find right now. You sure highlight a lot in your book, Dick. You're going to be quizzed when I'm done, too. This is the St. Francis prayer. Page 99, thank you. It's in big print, so it's probably 112 on this one. Now, if you're mind to, I'm not here to get you to do anything you want, but if you're mind to, and if you got something on your heart and your mind that you've been carrying way too long, I'm going to ask you just to sit here with me for a minute, close your eyes, and I'm going to read this prayer. And if it's applicable to you, apply it in your life. If it's not, then don't. Let's take a minute and close our eyes. Lord, make us a channel of thy peace. Where there is hatred, we may bring love. Where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness. That where there is discord, I may bring harmony. Where there is error, I may bring truth. And where there is doubt, I may bring faith. And where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, and it is by forgiving that one is forgiven. And it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. I'd like for those of us to care to close with the Lord's Prayer.
Marvelous Agahat. I was just thinking, looking out over this crowd, if we all started drinking, we could have one big time. This is also, today, June the 10th, is the anniversary of AA period, so it would be 70 years old today. I don't know why we can't clip this thing on. Yeah, that's much better. They gave me a few minutes, and if I go over, they got a big hook. They go, told me I couldn't ad-lib, so I can't talk. I can't ad-lib, usually we've had this done before by a professional every year. It's Avery. So you have an amateur here. But in June of 1941, I'm going to hold this because this is what I'm going to read from, and I'm not going to read it all. Can't do it in 10 minutes. But an Army officer named Steve Morris came to Atlanta from Washington, D.C., and he was looking for somebody that needed to. You need another alcoholic to talk to. So he put an ad in the paper. Post office box 1215. And we still have that same post office. 1215. Kind of a miracle. And then a former minister, Sam Daughtry, an alcoholic, he answered the ad, and then he went to the post office and wanted to see who it was that picked up the mail. They finally started talking, and each of them knew another alcoholic, and they got together, four of them got together and had their first little meeting in the basement of his home in Buckhead. Then they gradually added some folks, because the war started in 1942. And so a lot of folks were going to war, but they had a meeting place down there on Broad Street. Started off small, of course. I think they were, back in those days, they had big dreams of having a clubhouse, and you're going to have a recovery center, and you're going to put sober people up, and you're going to teach them how to get sober, all this kind of stuff. Have a restaurant. It was going to be first class. We have, unfortunately, usually personalities get in the way, and those things never work out. But anyhow, in 1946, they opened up a place, and the reason I know about this personally, because it was over a beer joint on North Avenue and Spring Street. Next door was the pool room, and upstairs, they had the meetings upstairs. I remember taking my father up there And he came back down the stairs and went in to the beer parlor and got drunk as a rodeo goat. I ended up carrying him home. I said, well, what about that place upstairs there? I said, that's AA. That's the first time I'd heard it. He said, oh, those people. No, that's not for me. Not for me. He died in Millersville later as a result of alcoholism. But they started there, and as in any place, seemed like you always have dissension about getting bigger or wanting to move out, or other groups wanting to do a little bit different. Then they had to leave. So they went to the YMCA, got a place there. They also got some good publicity from the newspaper. We had a Constitution, had some, I know, one the editor there, he was a big wheel to help out AA. They were trying to get him some money, I think, back then. I think, like Bill one time, he figured he was going to sell 1 million big books. Of course, he was going to make a little money on, you know, put in his pocket, I think. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But anyway, as they started, they decided that AA was a non-entity, so you can't own property or anything. And so the central office was called at that time ATALAN, or Atlanta Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know when I first went to AA in 66, they had the office in ATALAN. It was explained to me. So that they could have money, take in money. So our Atlanta Society was formed. Then they did, moved in 47 to another place. And they finally got them a club room over on West Peace Street. Then that's when I think he had a big dream. 522 West B Street. That club, they had they could have seating capacity of 400. The club room was nicely arranged. Listen to this. New furniture. I don't know who was furnishing all his money. Snack bar, a kitchen where regular meals were served. The partition separated the kitchen from the lounge, which was comfortably furnished. And Sam, a daughter of the preacher who had come into AA, delivered the first AA message at the meeting. A lot of the groups were starting. You don't really have time to go into all of the groups when they did start. I know my group, Jim City, started in 46, where four guys got together with a six-pack to talk about not drinking. Yeah. They didn't know you wasn't supposed to drink. I mean, they later found that out. Three of them dropped out. I mean, you know. But anyway, the fellowship has grown so much. We really don't have time to read this whole thing. I'll give you a quickie. That when I first came, almost next month will be 39 years, and we had 48 meetings in Metro. 48 meetings. And you had to, and none of this 90 meetings in 90 days, unless you went out of town somewhere. Now we have 1,400 and something. So if you get a resentment at this meeting, you just go down the street and go to another one. So we're very fortunate in this area that we have so many meetings to go to. And all because these guys that first started, and I'm sure they had no idea it was going to be as great as it was, just like Bill and Dr. Bob. They didn't know 70 years ago that AA is going to be what it is today. And I'm glad to be a part of it. And that's all I'm going to say.
Thanks, Speedy. Okay. Before I introduce the outgoing and incoming new steering committee members, I think that I've walked around the room today and tonight, and I've heard nothing but positive things about the experience here thus far, that the dinner was delicious, the parking was not so bad, and that things were handled very efficiently. And so I don't know if Al is in the room, but if we could give him a round of applause.
I was lucky enough to meet our speaker about 8 or 10 years ago. It was at in the parking lot of my home group. There next to the, or it was the Trinity Lutheran Church, next to the post office. On that, the car drove up, wheelchair came out of the car, and you know, we're taught to help anybody who looks like they need help. So I walk over and I say, "Hey, how can I help you?" He took one look at me and said, "Get out of the way, I'm going to do this." That was my introduction to Harry. That, as I say, was about 8 or 10 years ago, and he hasn't changed a bit. Harry's got 29 years of sobriety, and I don't think he looks like he's that old. He was a teenager when he first got sober. His home group is the Another Chance group. And I've learned to listen when Harry talks on that. I've heard him share numbers, usually at least once or twice a month. I've heard him tell his story, and I'm really anticipating listening to him talk tonight. I've been looking forward to it now for almost a month. I give you Harry.
I might run around with it on.
Well, that's fine. Well, then you do whatever floats your boat, okay?
All right. I might move around a little bit. So I might even fall off the platform. So I'll have to keep talk if all that happens. So if you say anything strange, just, you know, don't worry about it. Okay, I'll keep going. My name is Harry, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. Wow, what a good-looking bunch, man. Let me take a look at you all. God, what a sober bunch. Miracles. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Okay. A little louder? Okay. Can you turn up just a little bit more? Or? Okay. And I do this for a living. So, I can't turn it up. I'm sorry about that. Well, my name is Harry. I'm an alcoholic, like I said. And tell you a little bit about myself, what it was like, my experience. I was born in Valdosta, Georgia. My father was in the service at the time. And then we moved to New York. I grew up in New York. My father is an alcoholic. He's a member of this program, so I'm not taking his inventory. And you probably can't see me on this side, so maybe I'll move around a little bit. Does that look better? All right. I'd sing you a little song, but I'm not in that mood right now. The piano's covered up. It's out of my reach. So I grew up in New York. My father's in the program, and I have two brothers that are in the program. And so my first drink was at the age of 14 years old. And I can tell you, exactly where I was when I had my first drink. Now, I knew really nothing about it except for how my father was when he was drinking. And my father was a very violent drunk when he drank. And I've always said that I was not going to end up that way. That I was not going to end up that way because it was horrible growing up as a child. I have to tell you. So my parents, and I love my father very dearly today. He's a great man. My parents went away and they left me to take care of my two brothers. And there was we had a basement, and in the basement we had, my father was involved with the grocery store, so we had like tons and tons of cases of beer. When you manage a store, you own a store, they want their stuff right up front, so they're very willing to give you a keg or five cases of Beck's or Schaefer or whatever, you know, at that point, Budweiser. So when they left, as we're going down the staircase, my father had like scotch and whiskey, and I don't remember what it was exactly. But I thought, you know, I'm going to try this out, find out what this is all about. And I took the cap off, and I started drinking, and that warm sensation hit me. And it started going down. I could feel it going down. And I thought, whoa, this is something that I have never experienced before. And I thought, Jesus, I hated the taste. I just did not like the taste. But I liked the effect, that warm glow, that sense of that something was happening. And I really, really, really liked it. And I'll tell you, nothing else has ever done that to me. I mean, I've you know, bread has never done that to me. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? You know, if the doctor said to me, you know, maybe you should leave the bread alone, I'd say, sure. Why not? You know what I mean? But when it comes to alcohol, you know, I start questioning, man, what do you mean I need to stop? You know, drinking, you know. You got to be kidding me, you know? So my first experience with alcohol, I drank until I blacked out, actually. I didn't stop until I was in a blackout. There was a party actually up the street, and we went up the street and had the party, and then it ended up in my house. And I woke up the next morning, and my parents came home, and I mean, it was beer and all the ashtrays, and it ended up in my house. And that was a Dr. Jekyll, hot Mr. Hyde. One man was a nice guy, next man was a maniac. And I blacked out, and I woke up in... And I'd gotten in trouble. I mean, they got in the house and they stole stuff. I mean, it's just teenage stuff, you know what I mean? But you would think at that point that I would get the message, you know what I mean? That, you know, don't do this because there's trouble. But I didn't get that message. I didn't tie in that alcohol was the problem with that, see? I thought I just did something wrong, you know? Didn't tie it all with the alcohol. So from the age of 14 to 19 years old, I drank. You know, everybody I associated with drank like I did. I didn't drink. I didn't hang around with anybody who did not drink like me. I was lucky enough to grow a mustache at the age of 16 years old. So I mean, and bartenders probably knew. I mean, I grew up in a small town in upstate New York. You know, small towns, and they probably knew I was not of age, but they let me go in anyway and drink and hang out. So my high school years, you know, I didn't, you know, it was unfortunate. I didn't play football and I didn't play basketball in school. You know what I mean? I hung out in the bars. I also played. I was a musician. So I hung out with musicians, and a lot of them were older than me. You know what I mean? And they introduced me to marijuana and, you know, the rest of the stuff that goes on with being a musician and playing. So I was a kid. I played bass guitar. I was pretty good at it. And a lot of these guys were older than I am, you know, 5-6 years older than me. So I got involved with them and started playing. So, you know, my experience with school was very limited as far as sports and that and all that, you know, but I did get through high school and I did graduate. I don't know how in the world I did, but I did. So my experience with alcohol is this: lack of control. First drink, could not stop. Totally out of control. I was definitely powerless over alcohol. I did not know what was going to happen when I started drinking. I did not know where I was going to end up. And I was blacking out at that time. I would wake up in New York City, which is 2 hours away from where I was, and on a McDonald's, and I'd wake up by simply because I hit my head on the wall of a McDonald's. And I'd wake up and I'd be with friends, and I would say, "Where am I?" They say, "You're in McDonald's in New York City." And I would go, "Okay." And I'd get a little bite to eat, and then I'd be out again. So that's my experience with alcohol. I got in a little trouble, you know, the usual stuff, you know, barroom fights, you know, the typical, you know. My last experience last week, I had a couple of guys that just came back from the service. This was 74, and we had gone out and started drinking. I do remember at the age of 16 years old sitting in a bar, and shaking my first drink. And that's something I had never experienced before. When I started drinking, I started shaking before I started putting it down. And I do remember at that time when I was with my friends that I would literally had drank myself to be normal again. 3 days of staying up, I used alcohol to get me to a bad state of just feeling normal. So my buddies came in from town and we started going out drinking. And we started bar hopping, and I knew I was going to get in trouble because of, you know, I mean, you always, when you're drinking, you got an attitude. You know, bulletproof. I was 60 feet tall, bulletproof, and some guy's looking at my best friend's girlfriend, and I didn't like that. And before you know it, there's a fight, and it ends up outside, and, you know, he ends up back in the club through the glass window. You know, and the cops show up, and fortunately for us, we headed out. You could hide. Back then, there was no computers. You know, a lot of small towns, you know, you'd be in one town, you head out and go to another town, you know. And we went to this one club, and I walked up to the guy who was at the, you know, letting us in, and said, let me see your ID. And I said, sure, and I pulled out a $20 bill. I had no idea what he was saying to me. I was just handing him money, you know what I mean? And he said, and I did hear this. He said, you don't look like the guy in a $20 bill. And that pissed me off. You know what I mean? I mean, that pissed me off. So needless to say, we're in it with this guy, and the cops show up. We had just left another bar, you know, with the other situation. Cops show up, and they start taking me off, dragging me away. And as they were dragging me away, my two friends said, you know, started getting into it with the cops. You know, you can't do this. We're on, you know, he's our friend, and blah, 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 blah. So they said, okay, we're going to let him go, and we're going to take you two guys. So they let me go, and I thought, Jesus, what's going on here? So I said to one of the cops, you know, can I talk to you for a second? And I put my arm around this cop. And I don't know how I got my arm around this cop, but I got my arm around this cop. And I said this to him, hey, you know, God looks out for us. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he really does. You know, because I should have been on the ground. And I said to him very simply, I said, look, I said, I will make sure that we go home. Just let us go. We will go straight home, I promise you. And he looked at me and he started laughing. You know what I mean? He started laughing. And thank God we have people that were not drinking. We have some ladies with us. And the cop said, y'all going to take him home, drive him, get him out of here. And that was my experience with the cops. So my point is this. Never been in jail because of drinking. Definitely was getting in trouble. I never had a DUI. I never had problems with, quote-unquote, family members. All those things that you would say, maybe he's not an alcoholic. But I was definitely heading there. Continued drinking. My encounter with the police, I was definitely going to end up in jail. There was no doubt about it. And I knew that my drinking, there was something wrong with my drinking. See, because my father was leaving stuff laying around the house. You know what I'm saying? These 12 questions or 24 questions. You know what I'm saying? Like the big book. Just laying around. You know, I had hair down here, real long hair. I was playing in bands. And I thought, I'm going to look at one of these pamphlets. I know I'm not an alcoholic. And as I started going down the list, I think I said just about yes to everyone except not killing somebody or divorcing your wife. And I thought, ooh, you know, I'm definitely a candidate for the program. You know what I mean? And I really knew. I knew at the age of 16. I knew there was something wrong with my drinking. It didn't take a rocket science to figure it out. When you're blacking out like that, that's not normal behavior. You know what I mean? I've never had done that on a milkshake. You know what I mean? Blacking out somewhere and going, holy Christ. And so I knew deep in my heart there was something wrong with this. I knew there was something wrong. I did not know it was a disease. I did not know that not everybody drank like that. I thought when you drank, everybody did the same thing. They blacked out, they got in trouble. I thought everybody. I didn't realize that when other people drink, they can leave it alone. So, needless to say, I came home. I never forget this. It was on a Thursday afternoon. And I had one of my legs, I tore one of my legs up getting in a brawl out in the parking lot. And I came home and I thought, this is it, man. I got to stop. And I had that complete surrender. I just knew something had to change. Something had to give. And I came home to my father, and I said to my father, I got to stop drinking. Got to do something about this. So I went to my first meeting, and it was in East Paterson, New Jersey. And it was a podium-style meeting where you came up to the podium and you shared and then you sat down. And I will tell you something. When I walked into that room, I knew without a doubt that that's where I needed to be. I'm not sitting so far back. You know, that's where I needed to be. I knew that the jig was up for me, that there was something wrong with this, and I needed to do something about it. So I went to my first AA meeting, and they had two people, young people, come and bring me to my first meeting. It was a 14-year-old girl and a young guy that had I was 19 years old at the time. 1975 is when I sobered up. And I went to my first AA meeting. And, you know, I've said this many times, you know, your body, you know, I thought the 14-year-old was a heroin addict or something. Because how could she be in the program at the age of 14? It didn't register to me, you know what I mean? So I went to my first meeting, and I'm going to tell you something about, and I've said this, you know, AA back in 1975 in New York was just a little different. A little different. Tell me to go 90 meetings in 90 days. Tell me to take the cotton out of my ears and shove it in my mouth. Told me to get a sponsor. I picked a guy within 2 weeks. You know, they didn't mess around up there. I mean, they took you to meetings. They would not let me drive. My sponsor took me to meetings. And the only time I could speak was in a beginner's meeting. You know, I mean, that was it. You know, they would take me off to, and there was no holding hands during Lord's Prayer. We didn't hold hands. You know, you looked at the guy next to me and went, well, I don't know if I want to hold his hand. You know what I mean? I mean, he looked like a rough dude. I mean, the area that I came in was a lot of cops. You know, and you know, some of the earrings in there, like, you know, it's like they chew your head off. Hey, can I hold your hand during the Lord's Prayer? You know, I mean, it was just a little bit different. And you didn't shake either. You didn't do any of that. And that was confusing for me for a while. Because what do you say? What was it now? You don't drink and you won't get drunk or something like that. No, this guy we were saying, one day at a time, and I'm going, okay, it's a little confusing. You know, we need to kind of get this together here. You know, so there's been a lot of changes that I've seen. A lot of changes. And I've had to change with it. You know what I mean? I've had to change with it. Because I love this fellowship. So I went 90 meetings in 90 days. And I had a very, very, very good friend of mine named Tom Carlo that came in. I can say his name now because he passed away. Who came in the program, and he was the one that drove me home, and he was my drinking buddy. Him and this other guy named Dennis Quist. He said to me, Harry, if you're an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. 9 months later, he comes in the program. And Tom Carlo was a trip, man. I gotta tell you something. Tom just couldn't get it when it came to, I think he was the first one, and I've said this in meetings, that was, raise your hand. You don't raise your hand back in 75. You did not raise your hand and volunteer because they would take your arm off if you did it. You know what I'm saying? I think he's the one that started that. So, and the first time I ever spoke, and God bless those guys. You know, they saved my life. Those guys saved my life. I would say, you know, what is it about that third step? You know, we made the decision, that the word God, I would choke on it when I would hear that word God. I just couldn't take it. And in the big book, in A Comes of Age, it described me to the T. Defiant individuality does not brook any man or any God. And that's where I was at. I was defiant. Didn't want to believe in a God. I turned my back on God. I didn't like cops. I didn't like authority. I didn't like you. I didn't like myself. You know what I mean? And I thought I was terminally unique. You don't understand. I'm 19 years old. I don't need to be here. You don't understand. You know what I mean? And I found out through listening to you people that I was not unique. That I was an alcoholic. And there was no difference. No difference for me than you. Maybe you came in a little bit different time. Your experience was a little bit different. But when you drank and I drank, it changed us. And it changed me. So Tom came in and God bless Tom. He kept pushing those folks up there. You know what I mean? You know, and I had my sponsor. And Tom, and I know this is my story, but Tom was very much part of my story up there. Tom, one time, they just decided my sponsor sat on his side, and my father was his sponsor. He sat on this side. And every time Tom would go to raise his hand, he'd pull the hand down. You know what I mean? Every time Tom would raise his hand, he'd pull the hand down. They just would not let him share by raising his hand. And when I came in, the only thing they would do was read the preamble. We didn't read how it works. We didn't have the promises. We didn't read the promises. We didn't read the traditions. It was preamble, serenity prayer, into the meeting. And that's the way it was. There was no chips. You got a 90-day pin. You got 90 days. Well, if you had a year, they'd either give you a cup or a lighter for a year. And that was it. You know what I mean? They patted you on the back and said, okay, kid, what do you want from us? Another year? You know, you stayed sober. All right? So that's what it was in New York. And one year after being sober, you know, I decided I was going to move down to Georgia. I got tired of the cold weather. You know what I mean? I mean, I just got tired of the cold weather. I thought, I got to get out of here. This cold weather's driving me nuts. So I came down to Georgia in 1976. Now, I will say to you, I still had a problem with the word God. And my sponsor, she used to say to me, Guy, kid, just take it easy, man. Just use the word G-O-D, good orderly direction. Don't drink. Go to meetings one day at a time. Don't take yourself so darn serious. It's going to be okay. I said, well, what about that word of God? He said, kid, good orderly direction. Don't drink. Take the cotton out of your ears. Stuff it in your mouth. Listen. Learn the art of listening. You know what I mean? Learn the art of listening. Because if you're running your mouth, you're not listening. You're not hearing. So in 76, I moved out of New York. It was in November. And I came down to Georgia, and I've been here ever since. And Georgia's been a great state for me. I love Georgia. And it's been a while since I've been over to Lenox. And, you know, the second step, I knew I was crazy. Came to believe that a power greater than self could restore sanity. I knew I was nuts. You know what I mean? I knew I was crazy when it came to alcohol. There was no doubt in my mind. And I don't know when the change came with me with this God, this concept of a God. I don't know when that happened for me. But I was watching you people like a hawk. I was watching the ones that were speaking the word God and looking in your eyes and seeing if they really meant it. And I knew you people had something that I needed because I could see it in your faces. I could see it in your eyes. You had something that I wanted. I couldn't quite sure what it was, couldn't put my finger on it, but I knew that if I hung around, I would find out and come to find out that it is God. It's a spiritual way of life. Spiritual way of life, second to none. And I had no clue. I thought the only thing I had was a drinking problem. And come to find out, I also had a thinking problem. And I was powerless. And I needed to plug into a new source of power. And initially, you people were my source of power. I only seen God through you. And I did not know what it was initially. And at some point, it happened for me. And thank God for the loving fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You kept smiling at me and saying, kid, don't take yourself so serious. Don't drink. Go to meetings. It's going to be okay. And at some point it happened. And pain's a great motivator, too. Emotional pain's a great motivator. For me it is. I don't know anybody about anything else. I didn't apply any of those steps in my life until I was in the ring, man. I was like, Harry, if you don't do something about this, you're going to drink. And that's the way what it was with me with the four step. See, because I came in here at an early age, I didn't think I was had much problems like you folks. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Because I was young. I didn't put in all the time in. And come to find out, boy, I was a head case, man, you know what I mean? After you get it out of your system. And it took me, I met this guy named Bob B. And I thought when I came in here, I'd have to stop playing music. And for the first year, I did. I don't think I needed to be playing bars. I knew I didn't need to be in bars playing. And I met this guy in a program named Bob B. And we started playing together, me and him. And I started doing a lot of traveling together, me and Bob. On the road, going to a lot of meetings. White Cross. Anybody here from White Cross, Georgia? White Cross, Georgia. Yeah. Had some great times in White Cross. Yeah. Been to the, excuse me? Yeah. Yeah. All right. White Cross, yeah. All over Georgia. And I went to meetings, God darn it, because I needed it. In Columbus, Georgia. Great meetings in Columbus, Georgia. In White Cross, they used to come to watch me play, and they used to call themselves the Skidding on Thin Ice group. You know what I mean? Because, you know, we're sitting in a bar, you know, and they're sitting there, you know. But it's a good bunch. I've met a lot of so many nice people. When I've traveled, I go into a town like in Florida, Daytona, and pull into a meeting, you know, find out where the AA group was, and go in, and they just, I'm an alcoholic. They'd bring me right into the group. You know what I mean? Just loving people. You know what I mean? Sarasota. You know, I there's one point I was in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I was having a tough time, really tough time. And I picked up the phone. I called central office, and I said, "Man, I have got to talk to somebody." And this guy got on the phone, and he talked me down. Thank God for him. I probably never will see him. We probably don't know who he is. He might be sitting here, for all I know. And I said, "Man, I'm going to drink. I need to talk." And this guy talked me down. The old deal, dime therapy. Call, pick up the phone. I needed to utilize that. Please utilize that. It's a great instrument. Pick up the phone. You're going through something, pick it up. That's what I tell my people that I'm sponsoring. Call me. And I talked to this guy, and he talked me down, and I was able to get through it. So I feel very blessed to be a member of this program. And I thought drinking was going to be the end of the world because, see, I was young, 19. I had long hair. I was playing in bands. I thought, Christ, what am I going to do? Hang out with the old farts? You know what I mean? Talk about what? Metamucil? You know, stocks? You know, the children? You know, their houses? You know what? You know, I just couldn't see what I was going to do. You know what I mean? And what alcohol was taking away from me was my youth, and I didn't even know it. Didn't even know it. And what this program had given me back to me is my life. It gave me back my 19, my teens, and my 20s. You know what I mean? In my 30s. And I'm going to tell you something. It's been one heck of a journey. Wide awake. Yeah, sometimes. Most of the times. No drinking, no drugs. I've had to deal with a lot about Harry O'Brien and how he relates to the world and how Harry O'Brien relates to this power, this God. And I need you people. And I need this power. I need this spiritual power in my life. I cannot do it without you. And I cannot do it without this God. Cannot do it. Some point I got into doing the fourth step. It was tough for me. I couldn't understand the fourth step for a long time. You know what I mean? Until pain was so tough. I was in Daytona Beach, Florida, and I got done with this gig. And I thought, man, I have got to do something, or I'm going to pick up a drink. And it's amazing how easy the fourth step is, you know, at that point. You know what I mean? Picked up that big book, and I started going through that fourth step and going, where was this before? You know what I mean? It's just so easy. You know what I mean? I got my pen out and my pen, and I started writing. And it's amazing when you write it down on a piece of paper and you look at it and you go, oh, my God. This is what's going on with you, Harry. You know what I mean? Yay, 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 you know? You've got a lot of stuff going on there, kid, you know? And so thank God for the steps. I'm starting to get tangled up. So the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has been a blessing for me. It's been not been easy for me to take those steps, like I said. I did not want to take any of those steps until, I was in a lot of pain. And what those steps has taken me to is softening my heart. It's giving love in my heart. It's giving me a relationship with the God of my understanding. It's given me a relationship with you because I had a massive ego when I got in here. And with those 12 steps, I believe, this is just my opinion, you can take it or leave it, it cracked that massive ego that I had. And I started developing, it brings me to this power. It brings me into relationship with this God. It brings me into relationship with you. And hopefully, of being of service, like so many of you are in here. And what a miracle that is. Because I was so God-darn self-centered and can still be that way and egotistical. And that we're all sitting here tonight on a Friday night, like Speedy said, and we're all miracles. All flat-out miracles. All flat-out miracles. And there's a lot of people in here I haven't seen in a long time. And so I continue to take personal inventory. and I continue to meditate and I continue to pray. Because it's vital for me. Self-examination, meditation and prayer is vital for me. Conscious contact with this power is vital for me. I try when I wake up in the morning, I really have two choices. It's my opinion. I can have a lousy day, I can have a good day. When I live under self-propulsion, like it says in the big book, in the third step, I'm headed for trouble. When I don't turn it over to God and start praying and meditating, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace, whether it's hatred I may so love, whether it's darkness, light, whether it's sadness, joy, whether it's despair, hope. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, as to be understood, as to understand, as to love, as to love. For it is by giving that we receive. It is by forgiveness that we are forgiven. It is by dying to self that we are born to eternal life. And it's a powerful prayer, gang. It's a powerful prayer. I want to be an instrument. And I know you want to be an instrument. 1983. It's coming for an AA meeting in Howe Place. Stopped to help this guy on the side of the road. Knew a lot about cars back then. Got out of my car to help this guy and said, look, I need a jump. And I said, okay. And he started jumping his car. He got out of his car and he's putting gas in the carburetor, getting out, trying to start. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get out and help this guy. I got out to help, primed the carburetor. I said, look, don't start the car. You know the deal. Get away from the car, start the car. The car was not starting up. Got out of the car. We had a little conversation about new carburetor. You had a new fuel pump. You know, maybe it's a ignition system back to 74. This was 83, so they still had carburetors in the old... I don't know why I have to say that. But anyway. So I said, okay, a couple more times. And if it don't go, you know, we'll just can it, okay? So he gets in the car, goes to start the car, pull my head out underneath the hood, didn't start, primed it one more time, started to try to start the car, car blew up, caught me on fire. Gas can blew up, caught me right square in the face. Opened my eyes, and I came out from underneath that hood so quick it'd make your head spin. And I opened my eyes, and all I could see was flames. And I tried to wipe it off with my hands, and I knew I had gas on me. Anybody's had gas on, you know that it doesn't stop burning until it's gone. I knew there was a creek. I did not know that that creek was an 8-foot drop. I couldn't see where I was going. I knew it was there because I pulled up to it, and I dove in the creek. Next thing I remember, I heard a concussion here, flames going out. I did get the water out, the flames out. Next thing I could see is my legs coming down in front of me. I landed on my back, thank God, instead on my stomach. I see my legs coming down, and I became numb, like somebody hit your hand with a hammer. That numb feeling, I had a numbness from here down. My legs coming down, I seen them, could not feel them. I just saw them coming down. And I thought, this is not good. Not good. And I thought, okay, I can shake this off. I was 28 years old. I jogged every other day. I was weightlifting. Didn't drink. Didn't smoke. I thought, I can get up. Tried to get up. Was not getting up. As I was trying to get up, I noticed that my breath, I started losing my diaphragm muscles. And my breathing was becoming shorter. And I was bleeding. And at that point, when I tried to get up one more time, and I seen the gentleman stand up in the corner, I mean, he was freaked out. I don't blame him, because one minute I'm helping him, next minute I'm like a flying torch. You know what I mean? And he was just frozen. And I realized I was not getting out of that hole. It was not going to happen. At that point, I had a tremendous sense of peace come over me. Like somebody injected all of Lennox Mall in me. And you all have experienced this peace. And it says it in page 100 of the 12 and 12. You might experience a little bit of the kingdom of heaven. And at that point, that's exactly what I felt I was experiencing. I felt a thickness. I felt like something had grabbed a hold of me. Tremendous peace. And I became very, very aware of the trees, very aware of how peaceful everything was. And I will tell you, right then and right there, I could have left and it would not have bothered me. Not one iota. Because I sensed a great deal of love. And I also had this other thought that came to me, and it said to me, Harry, you're going to learn more about yourself than you would have ever learned before. And I thought, that is the most craziest thought I have ever heard. I am laying in this ditch, not having a very good day, and I'm getting this message. And I thought, can you give me somebody else? Hello? You know what I mean? Somebody else there? And the craziest thing, you're going to think I'm crazy. I all of a sudden got this sense of excitement. And I thought, what? I have never experienced this before. My family, I started thinking about my family. How were they going to take it? Because of Wilkins. Because I knew I was going to be okay. Because I was shown so much love. Do you understand? At that point. I was concerned about them. I hoped they were going to be okay. You know? For them not to worry. Because I thought I was dying. You know? I don't know how many times I've told that story. But that is... I start crying every time. About that time, this guy jumps down the hole. He says, what's your name? So my name is Harry. He wants my social security number. I said, why do you want my social security number? No, okay. he was trying to keep me awake. Yeah. Finally, at some point, the ambulance showed up. And they pulled me out of that hole. And took me to Smyrna Hospital. I was soaking wet. I was burnt. I was bleeding. I was in pain. And they took me to Smyrna Hospital. And they started cutting my clothes off. And my wife showed up. And God bless her, man. I mean, she looked like she had seen death warmed over, you know. And they proceeded to put me in traction. No, they took me from there to Northside Hospital. And at Northside Hospital, they put me in traction. They put the prongs in your head. Took me to the north side, and the doctor kept saying, why don't you curse? Because all I kept saying was, God help me. You know what I mean? He says, why don't you say, like, you know, one F word or something besides God. Will you please? You know what I mean? I mean, it like shocked me. I was like, Doc, you know, take care of me. Will you put that? Don't worry about me. You just take care of putting those prongs. No. So I was in Northside Hospital, emergency room, and I was there for about 2 weeks, you know, in emergency room. They had me in traction, and they let everybody come in and visit me. Everybody that I knew. I mean, I had everybody that you could think of come to the hospital to see me in that emergency room. And I have some friends that were chiropractors. And God bless one guy. I was sponsored. His name was Joey. And he was laying on the bar where the weights were. And he didn't realize that he was putting tension on my... He was pulling my neck back. You know what I mean? And he started to be a chiropractor. And I said, Joe... I said, Joe, you need to kind of take your hand off that stand you're leaning on. You're pulling my neck. And he's just like almost freaked out, you know. And I'm like, I'm going to become my first patient, you know what I mean? All my nurses, I think they did this on purpose because I told them right away. I said, I am in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, do not jack me up. I am in the program and I plan on continuing to stay sober, okay? And I had just celebrated, and the accident was on October 3rd, 1983. So all my nurses were in the program. So when I couldn't sleep, they'd come in and we'd talk, program, you know. There was one nurse there that just came in. She had 6 weeks. And she'd come in and we'd talk about the fellowship, you know, and what it had done. What it had done for my life and where she needed, you know, and where she was going. And at that point, they had moved me to Shepherd. No, they had done my surgery at Northside Hospital. Fused my spinal cord. So they moved me to Shepherd Spinal Clinic. And down at Shepherd, they started having AA meetings for me down here. And there was a ton of people that would show up to see me. And while I was in Northside, Speedy would come and see me. And Speedy came up there and seen me, and I remember walking in the room, and I was sitting up, I was having a hard time breathing, because, you know, when they sat me up for the first time, it almost knocked me out, man. You know, it was like, geez, what? It was like putting a punch in me. And Speedy came in, and he told me, like, the two war stories, you know, that he was flying a plane, and he crashed this one in the Guineas, and he was up in the trees looking around, and they told me another one about this other plane that he crashed, and then Speedy just disappeared. Just left. And I went, Speedy, okay, appreciate you sharing your story with me, Speedy. He was just gone. He just left, you know. God bless Speedy. And Pat, you know, then I had my sponsor, Pat W. A lot of you know Pat. W'd come up, and God, that guy would be this huge guy, and he'd give me a bear hug, and I thought it was going to break my neck again. Just grab a hold of me, you know, and hug me. Oh, it's going to be all right. And I was like, you know what I mean? I'd have my friend Tom Carlo. I'm going to read the 24-hour book to you right now. Like, you know, like I was going somewhere, right? You know what I mean? Like, he had me as a captive audience, finally. You know what I mean? You know, you really need this. Well, okay. So I started having meetings for me. And back at Shepherd at that point, you could smoke. And they didn't realize, you know, my eyelashes were burned off. My hairs, my eyelashes were burned off. And the smoke was like, pulled me in the room. It was like, good God, you know? They'd be smoking, yeah, we're staying sober. And what about you, Harry? And he's like, hey, you're killing me here, you know? The smoke. You know, Lynn B. and Joe F. A lot of you know Joe F. Been around sober a long time. He's passed away. And about that time, Mike M. was in a program. And he wrote an article that went to Louis Guzzard. Louis Guzzard put the article in the paper. And I started getting all these letters from people. And people coming to the hospital. And I had the news come to me, Channel 2, Channel 5. And they had heard what happened. And I had this huge influx of people supporting me and coming to me to the hospital and sending me cards and saying, just hang in there, it's going to be okay. And as his Louis Guzzard's article was hitting across the country, out in the Midwest, started getting letters from these people that I don't even know idea who they are. You know what I mean? Just good people. Good people. Something that was because of you people. Because of you people would not have experienced something like that. Because the way I was going, I would have not known about good people. You know what I mean? Because my attitude was not that. You know what I mean? And I started getting these letters, and I got these old people, wearing these overalls, and they old couple, they come and see me at the hospital. And they'd hand me a check. And they'd say, tears in their eyes, and say, God, just hang in there. I didn't know them from Adam. You know what I mean? And the guy would give me a hug, and his wife would hug me, and they'd go, and I'd never see him again. You know what I mean? I mean, those type of people are a blessing. It was something new experience for me that I don't know if I would have had my accident, if I would have experienced that kind of love, that kind of outpouring to people, that there is a lot of good in this world, that there is a lot of good people in this world, a lot of people that are godly people, that are living a spiritual life, that are loving. Do you know what I'm saying? You know? And I'm going to tell you something. It was not easy for me. Being 28 years old and not being able to walk. It was tough. It was really tough. And I had to rely on my sponsors. And I had to rely on the 12 steps and the meetings. I went to a lot of meetings, man. Because I know if I didn't, I probably would have drank. and I didn't want to do that. You know what I mean? And I'll say this, that experience that I had in that ditch stayed with me for a long time. And I still, in my heart, still, it was like something put, a little tag. You know what I'm saying? A little tag. And it's still with me today. And it's God. You know what I'm saying? It's a spiritual way of life. So there's been many changes in my life. Many changes in my life. And I have to continue to practice this program. Continue to apply these steps. Every day that I get up, to quiet this internal dialogue that goes on. I don't know anybody else. You don't have that going on up there, do you? You know, the riot that goes on up here. The chaos. You know what I mean? That goes on up here. You know. And I have to get up when I start my day. I start my coffee and I say, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. When there's hatred, I may sow love. And I go through that prayer until my consciousness changes. It raises up. You know what I mean? Because life, gang, is too short. We've all been given a great gift. A great gift. And I refuse now to let those moments go. Because it's too short. It's too precious. I found that out when I had my accident. Every morning I wake up and I look at my legs and I go, my God, it's too short to be unhappy. In the big book it says, happy, joyous, and free. You know what I mean? We can be happy, joyous, and free. I live alone and I thought, why am I unhappy? I'm in my own home. What's the deal? So I got another choice. There's nobody there. And it took me until me living by myself and praying and meditating and going, you know, I don't have to buy that anymore. You know what I mean? I don't have to buy that hatred anymore. And I can change. I can change with love. And that's what I attempt to practice every day. And it's not easy. Don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting here saying it's a piece of cake. Because I am a nutcase. I love to be in control. You know what I mean? I would love to be in control. So it takes a lot for me to stay present. And also to be able to give back. You know what I mean? To give back. You know what I mean? And that's what's all done. Anything? You know what I'm saying? Staying sober. Carrying the message to another alcoholic. Living happy, joyous, and free. And it's... I don't know what time it is. What time is it? 15, 20 minutes? Wow. All right. Okay. I'll keep talking. Is that all right? Anybody want dessert? Go ahead. That's okay. Go get dessert. Come back. Yeah. So I try to live each day as best I possibly can. And not drink and work with others. Because it's critical. You work with somebody new, and they want to take you through the big, or they want to talk about the big book, it makes me go, oops, Harry, you need to get back in your big book. You know what I mean? You don't know what you're talking about here. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? Even I'm sober 29 years. You know what I mean? And every time I open up that big book, and the 12 and 12, something sticks out, and I go, when did they put that in there? You know, courtesy, kindness, justice, and love. I never read that in the 12 and 12. On page 100, when did they put that in there? You know what I mean? When did that happen? You know what I mean? Or on page 133, you know, that I am the maker of my own misery, the deliverer. And I've been really, you know, they knew what they were doing when they put that in there, because I'm very obsessive. And when they put in there, deliberate manufacture of misery, I go, what? Are you kidding me? Me? I don't do that. I want to be happy. What do you mean that I manufacture my own misery? Well, yeah. Yeah, well, Harry, you do. You know what I mean? Maybe because you cheat a little bit, or you think you can do something that you're not going to get in trouble with. Or that maybe I could be selfish. You know what I mean? Not doing God's will. Yeah, I'm manufacturing my own misery. You know what I mean? By not doing God's will. Self-propulsion. When I'm into what Harry O'Brien wants, I am making my own misery. Trust me. I'm manufacturing it. And it's going to come down the pike, you know. If I didn't stay sober, bottom line is this. It's a gift. When I don't drink, one day at a time, it is a God-darn miracle. And the icing on the cake is if I can get out of myself and have a loving heart, it's a home run time, game. It's a home run time. And I can look at you and realize that we're all on the same path. Different parts of the road, we're on the same path. And whoever would have thought that alcoholism, this disease, would have brought us to this point. 70 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. What would have happened if they never met? We wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be up here sharing this with you, my story. It wouldn't have happened. This moment would not have happened. So trust me. It's God-inspired. It's definitely divine what's happened here. We're very, very fortunate. Only 70 years of mankind. 70 years. That's like throwing a little seed in time. You understand what I'm saying? And we've been blessed with such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful program. And I appreciate you. You know, I really want a piece of cake. So I think I'm going to... I think... Anybody have any questions? No. Well, thank you very much. I love you. God bless you all. Thank you. Bless you.